Scrolling for May 30th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Brother Chip Hessenflot.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
We're back again with another fun exploration into the world of Sherlock Holmes. Right?
Sweeping love song.
This is chapter 9 of A Study in Scarlet and has nothing to do with Sherlock Holmes.
It's a Harlequin romance here. In the middle of a Sherlock Holmes story.
Right. We are in the middle of a Sherlock Holmes mystery, but we have this intermission where we are in a completely different time, 40 years before the murder happens, and we're finding some really interesting backstory of these characters.
Okay.
So let me just ask, this is so unusual. How did you guys like this rather short chapter?
I keep wondering where we're going to, you know, why is this information important? We've got this mystery that kind of ended. We solved part of it, and he said, "Hey, let's go back and study something that we probably could have gotten done with in a single chapter." But who knows? We've got a story. It's okay. I'll see where it goes.
I agree with you. This is good writing. This is interesting, fun information, but it seems like it's way too much information. It's intriguing, but it's so much different from anything that we've read before. I think that one chapter of this intermission was just fine. That first chapter yesterday that we discussed, and we got some really interesting conversation out of, but now we're getting into such intimate details on this side of the story that even Holmes could not have deduced about these characters 40 years later when this murder happened. I don't know where we're headed with this.
And I think that one of the things that's really interesting about this first Sherlock Holmes story is that the genre of detective fiction is only just developing at this point, right? So we have its development in the dime novels and the penny dreadfuls happening, you know, a little bit before, but very much at the same time. And Sherlock Holmes was a major factor in really developing the genre that we expect of detective fiction. And here we have two totally different genres coexisting in one space. We have that detective story, which ends up just being a frame. And then we have this basically like this sort of exotic travel tale. Like what happened historically all the way in North America 40 years ago? Like, let me tell you this interesting story about, you know, people you don't know. And of course, you know, with limited access to encyclopedias, you know, a lot of people wouldn't know anything about the Mormons. So this could be super interesting. It's just not detective fiction.
I hadn't thought of the Sherlock Holmes story as being the frame for this tale. That's a very interesting way of looking at this.
Well, Steve, in Star Wars terms, I think this would be called the prequels. I'm just throwing that out there.
And it's just as interesting as those, but the dialogue is so much better.
Nothing about sand in this one, right?
Sand so far.
Lots of sand.
They could have mentioned sand when they were stranded in the desert, but they didn't.
I hate sand.
This is so interesting, Pam. You're right. This is the main thrust of the story is in the frame of the Sherlock Holmes tale. Interesting.
And so as we're really getting this exploration of Mormons in America, and, you know, that would be fairly new to a lot of readers in 1887 England. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you guys, what did you notice in terms of, is this generally a positive or a negative portrayal of the Mormons? How does he sort of, what kind of techniques does he use in portraying this exotic people?
I would say it's a fairly positive statement on the Mormons as I was reading it. And my thought on that is because they talk about how industrious they were when they got to the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm.
They immediately throw up a temple. We're talking about the gentleman we're following. He is industrious. He's a very good hunter. He knows how to put together a farm. And because of that, of course, they're prospering. And it seems like that when they got to the Promised Land was delivering what they were putting into it, the hard work they were putting into it.
hardworking, industrious, devoted to their belief system, and there's no negative statements about anything they're doing. Even those things that we might raise an eyebrow at, there's no eyebrow raising in this Doyle tale.
Well, and it's interesting because, of course, one of the famous things that's different about the Mormon religion is the acceptance of bigamy. And did you guys notice that bigamy is mentioned, but it's only in like one little clause? Little Lucy Ferrier was born along pleasantly enough in Elder Stangerson's wagon, a retreat which she shared with the Mormon's three wives and with his son, a headstrong, forward boy of 12. Mm-hmm. So his three wives is just in a tiny clause there, and it's not pulled out for analysis at all.
Yeah. Well, polygamy is not allowed in the Mormon faith now. There is a sect of it that is sort of divided from the church, but that was something that was truly was part of their history at that time.
Sure. And in 1887, this was one of the things that would really distinguish the Mormon people.
Sure.
From, you know, the folks in London.
Absolutely.
And so I just thought it was interesting that he didn't sensationalize that, because he could have, and mm-hmm. he chose not to. So just mm-hmm. as we keep going here, it'll be interesting to think about what decisions Doyle was making in his portrayal. I also think that he really does try to remind the reader that the Mormons are coming from like an Anglo-Saxon background. So early on in the chapter, he says, "The savage man and the savage beast, hunger, thirst, fatigue, and disease, every impediment which nature could place in the way, had all been overcome with Anglo-Saxon tenacity." So this is like an exoticized group of people, but they have the same roots as we here in London, I think is what he's saying.
To me, that is an interesting statement by Doyle, mm-hmm. because I can tell you, I don't think the promised people, the Jewish people who were with Moses, I don't think they're the Anglo-Saxons. And I think the Mormons in many ways identify like the chosen people. They found their promised land. They were basically, and I think their story as they tell it certainly has beat for beat with, you know, Moses helping find the promised land for the Jews.
Now, the other thing I thought was really interesting, we've talked about the representation of the Mormons as super industrious. Did you guys notice the emblem when he says the Latter-day Saints were as busy as the bees whose hive they have chosen for their emblem?
I did. I don't know much about the Mormons, so I did not know that that is their emblem, but it makes sense. The industrious, that is one of those characteristics that we have, the stereotypes of these people.
Is this foreshadowing to what Holmes will retire to?
Well, I was kind of thinking that it's interesting that, you know, Holmes is to retire to become a beekeeper in the future. So I just hadn't noticed that detail before, and I thought it was interesting, especially because, as we've talked about many times, Doyle is so interested in representations using animals.
If the bee is representing the Mormon, why did Brigham Young University choose the cougar as their mascot and not the bee? That would be far beyond this podcast.
That's a question for another day. Anakin, you'll be the death of me. Foreshadowing.
So now, what connections did you guys see with part one of the novel?
Not many.
This pause. No, there's two connections. Come on.
Okay, there are two connections, but they are in there, and we the reader are trying to solve a mystery. We are being given these clues to try to solve a mystery, and it's very difficult for me to remember that this is a Sherlock Holmes story. I got to tell you, Pam, if this was the kind of writing that Doyle gave us every time, I don't know that we would be doing a daily podcast right now.
Yeah.
That first part is so good, though. The first part of this book is just rocking.
The first chapter of this story is very good. We had a very good conversation mm-hmm. yesterday, but I'm tired of this type of writing right now.
Well, that's because we were thrown...
Flower of Utah.
We were thrown on Tatooine, Steve. We've got to trudge our way through this to figure out what the connection is.
Okay, so Pam, tell us what the connections are.
All right, well, we have, I found two connections. Maybe you guys found more. There's the young Stangerson boy of 12. He's a headstrong, forward Mormon boy of 12. And he's in the wagon with Lucy as they're traveling. So he would be 52 in the present day. Is he the secretary? Maybe, I don't know, the murdered man. And then Jefferson Hope, of course, who we know is the cabbie, who is the murderer. We have left Jefferson Hope with handcuffs on. So, mm-hmm. Meet him.
So he's there, and probably young Stangerson is the Stangerson that we see 40 years later. So we've got those two characters, which is fine. It's just wrapped up in all of these details about this love affair.
Well, and
a little lonesome dove going on right now.
Right.
So it's so funny because when you think about, like, what is the main occurrence in this chapter? If you had to do a plot summary.
I kind of broke down this entire chapter. I said, right. We get the man and the young girl who are ideal friends people. You know, the man's hard work and prosperous. You know, God rewards the gifts he has. And the young girl is the ideal child and symbolizes the ideal growth into womanhood on the frontier. But we really are going to have the young girl becomes the woman, and then the young girl meets a young man. Woohoo!
And she's on a horse and she needs to be rescued, and he comes and rescues her, and that's, you know, it's speed on horses.
Well, there's cows around there, Steve.
There's cows, yeah.
It's not speed.
Speed on horses. They had an exciting adventure together and they fell in love.
Well,
Keanu Reeves.
That's right.
Hello, Canadian. So I was reading the chapter to my daughters last night, and there came a moment when my 11-year-old stopped me and was like, okay, wow, that's a man writing what he thinks a woman might be thinking. And I was
thinking, oh, yes, she is Pambador's daughter. Yes, she's awesome.
I will tell you where that happened. So this is when we get this sort of narrative, third-person narrator telling us about Lucy's development. It was not the father, however, who first discovered that the child had developed into the woman. It seldom is in such cases. That mysterious change is too subtle and too gradual to be measured by dates. Least of all does the maiden herself know it, until the tone of a voice or the touch of a hand sets her heart thrilling within her, and she learns with a mixture of pride and fear that a new and a larger nature has awoken within her. There are few who cannot recall that day and remember the one little incident which heralded the dawn of a new life.
That is right out of a Harlequin romance right there.
I will admit that both children made vomiting motions at that point.
That is so awesome. It is so over the top.
And then we go briefly into the perspective of Jefferson Hope, this hard-faced young man. The sight of the fair young girl, as frank and wholesome as the Sierra breezes, had stirred his volcanic undine to its depths. And I was like, oh dear.
The fire that burns within my soul.
So, yeah.
This is not a detective story. This is a Harlequin romance. He's created another genre within a genre.
And it's interesting because we learn that Jefferson Hope is a great storyteller. He had been a pioneer in California and could narrate many strange tales of fortunes made and fortunes lost in those wild halcyon days. And that phrase, halcyon days, really reminded me of Robert E. Howard, who's going to be writing, who had already begun, but who's going to be writing in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. He wrote Conan the Barbarian stories, and he uses the word halcyon so much in those stories. It's this attempt to, like, imagine this fantasy world that has this great, like, nostalgic connection of humans to nature. Like, Conan the Barbarian, he is a natural man. in contrast to the more effete masculinity of early 20th century Americans. And so I thought that was interesting because I feel like there is this way that Doyle is working in two different models of masculinity here. I might be reading too much into that word choice, but it did kind of make me think, like, what is masculinity in the at the turn of the century, in the late 19th and early 20th century? How is it changing with civilization? You know, where do you place the work of Holmes and Watson in comparison to this, like, pioneering farming that we see 50 years earlier? So anyway, there's something here, even though, yeah, there's a little bit of a oh dear factor to this chapter.
So Halcyon describes sort of an age in the past, sort of ideal age, and you're saying Robert E. Howard.
I recently reread the Conan stories, and he uses that word all the time.
Interesting. So there was a, you know, the idea of the Conan stories was, you know, Atlantis is falling, and this is the period of time in between the Hyberian Age, between that period of time, the ideal, and the modern age. I don't know which.
Right. And Conan refuses to modernize. Like, that's
absolutely
the whole Conan stories. And therefore, he is this, like, more pure model of masculinity.
Well, obviously, you know, since the COVID-19 is going on, I've been able to grow my locks out and become, you know, super buff and pretty handy with a sword.
The idea of idealizing a past time, this frontier ideal, is certainly at play here. This idea that we live in London. Doyle has said a lot of things about London, that he loves the city, but he also sees the adventure of the country. This is the outback. This is the frontier where anything goes. And the idealism of that is on display here.
In this story, this brief passage did remind me a little bit of the short story from the first set, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, The Noble Bachelor, where Miss Hattie Duran was in England. She was an American girl in England, engaged to a nobleman, and then her American adventurer husband, Frank Moulton, shows up. Remember that one? This was a while ago.
And Doyle certainly thinks that those times were somehow better than what we're doing today. And that's, I think that's what we're hearing from this Halcyon days of this tale. This was a better idea than what we have.
It's not just at that period of time. Even today, people kind of sit down and they talk about the past as somehow being a better time or any number of things. I mean, it's just part of people thinking.
Getting old.
I mean, I don't know how many.
Remember, Doyle is 27 here when he's writing this. So he's not looking back to his childhood. He's going way back and going, that was better.
And across to North America, too, right? So I think that's, like, there's this sort of exotic piece.
Before they were shooting people out into space, you know?
Or trying to, depending on what happens on Saturday.
Exactly.
So this does come to an ending, right, Pam?
Devastated.
Can you tell that I didn't like this chapter very much?
I really like endings normally, but woo. All right, well, we'll just read it. So Jefferson, he says goodbye to Lucy. I'll be back in 2 months. He tore himself from her as he spoke, and flinging himself upon his horse, galloped furiously away, never even looking round, as though afraid that his resolution might fail him if he took one glance at what he was leaving. She stood at the gate, gazing after him until he vanished from her sight. Then she walked back into the house, the happiest girl in all Utah.
Woo! And the 11-year-old Bart.
Oh, well, you know what? It certainly was an interesting evening. Everyone is suntanned. Everyone is super strong. It must be like Wobegon. Everyone's above average. Certainly right there.
It is idealizing this situation. Doyle really thinks that he would have been happier here, it seems, in this writing.
Well,
he's got a mission to accomplish. And he'll be back.
Except, my friends, that we know that it all ends in some sort of murder and we don't know why. And so, I mean, I think that's the other piece of it, right? So I'm pointing out, like, all of these sort of idealized pieces, and we're all, you know, looking at that. But within that frame, we know that this ends in a horrible murder.
40 years later.
Right. So how do we get from there to here? Like, but where it's going is a murder that's going to shock to his core our young Watson, who's an army medic, for crying out loud. So, you know, there is a sort of, I mean, in a way, he's making this so sunny and bright, happiest girl in all of Utah, in order to show how dark it's going to get.
Right. Which is good writing.
Mm-hmm. But she's the Padme.
One chapter of this would have been fine. Two chapters of this is getting a little not what I, this is not what I bought when I bought this magazine in 1887. I want a murder mystery.
It isn't? This is the backstory. No. This is, like I said, this is Padme and Anakin sharing floating exactly. fruit, you know?
And you know how much I hate the prequels. You know how much that those ruined my childhood, and I don't watch them on Christmas. I watch Star Wars, and those are not included.
You were the chosen one.
Yes.
Well, my friends, settle in. We're not going back to yet.
Oh, this podcast is over.
Grab a sandwich, settle in. We'll stay in Utah for another couple chapters.
Absolutely. I hope everybody out there is grabbing a sandwich and finding some joy in this, finding that ideal lifestyle that used to be, that long ago and far away lifestyle that you loved so much, and enjoying our conversation while you're stuck at home. Hopefully you're getting a sandwich. We're going to go to the Blue Box and grab a sandwich. That's what we're going to do. But hopefully you are going to keep listening, keep reading, and keep sharing with us. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, send us a voicemail, follow our hashtag TM. As Sherlock Holmes, we will get to chapter 10 of A Study in Scarlet tomorrow. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenplug.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Brother Hasenplug.
Here's my sandwich.
Release the sandwich. At the Blue Box, right?
At the Blue Box.